Ostensibly because we have the funeral of Lindsey Graham coming up. There are two meetings that are going to happen today in the White House at various times between Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump. Now, these things seem to be separate on the surface, but one wonders, are there actually some connections between the two? And I think when you do some investigation, you'll find out there are some disturbing similarities between the two. We're going to take these in part here and look at both of them because President Trump is making some comments on both the Iran war and there's some issues going on that you might not have heard about on the Russia-Ukraine war, and you need to hear both. And to try and help us make sense out of all this and see how these things tie together, we have back with us today Colonel Douglas McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst and former advisor to the Secretary of Defense and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, as always, welcome back to the show.
Well, I think we can try to explain some things, but if you want us to make sense, forget it.
Okay, fair enough. Fair clarification. And I think that actually some of these comments are going to show just how right you are on some of those. President Trump this morning went on Fox and Friends and was kind of giving a lay of the land to his favorite outlet there about where things are. First of all, we'll talk about the Iran war. Turns out, actually, we're in pretty good shape there. And we'll start off with the most important financially thing aspect of this, which is Strait of Hormuz, and along with all the oil and gas products that go along with it. Good news, Doug. We're in control.
Well, Iran doesn't control the strait. We control the strait.
Mr. President, are we right that no merchant ships are getting through right now, maybe three or four a day when you need about 100?
The only ones that get through are the ones that we want to get through. They're the only ships that get through, Brian. We have a blockade that's so powerful that nobody can get through.
Nobody can get through. Now, Brian Kilmeade, Doug, in front of the Rare Times, actually tried to push back a little bit, and it turns out he was much more right than we think. When Trump's saying that we're in control of the Strait of Hormuz and we're in good shape, this is from the last few days. This is important, not just in the numbers, but where they're passing. We've had information from Kepler and a number of other places to say fewer than 10 ships have passed through the strait since Sunday. 25 had just three vessels, the 25 of July, and then the 3 days, 22 through 24 July, three vessels per day. But here's the important part. The Southern Corridor, the one that the United States set up outside of the Memorandum of Understanding that was not included in that, according to analysts from Windward and Kepler Commercial Shipping along the southern route, despite being escorted by U.S. military, has effectively ground to a halt. The Northern Corridor, a handful of vessels still navigating the straits, are mostly utilizing the Iranian shipping lanes. So there's not a whole lot going out even then. But President Trump said ours is like this blockade, but some is going out there and nothing is coming out on our side. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know what to make of it, except that President Trump is not in the business of telling people the truth about events in the Middle East or anywhere else right now. Remember, this is the quintessential salesman. So everything he's connected to is a tremendous success. Everything he talks about is always a winning hand and so forth and so on. The problem is that the rest of the world knows the truth. We don't control the Strait of Hormuz. Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz. And for him, that's a very difficult thing to admit because that means that we have lost our control and influence over the global energy complex. We just don't control it anymore. It by definition, and if you look at what I'm sure you're going to bring up in a few moments, the destruction meted out to the Saudis and others in the Gulf in terms of oil infrastructure and refining, becomes very clear that Iran has absolute control. And we are in an unfortunate position of not being able to do anything about it. So I understand he doesn't want to admit that. But unfortunately, that's true. And that leads to the discussion of what will be openly discussed in this meeting in Washington with Netanyahu.
And, you know, even before we get on that, I want to go down a point you just mentioned there. And this gets back into something we've talked about before, but there's a new manifestation of it, that the oil price has gone down significantly here since the oil trading opened back up Monday morning. And that's odd because the news out today, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, they admitted that because of some of their some of the Houthi damage, missile damage to their Yanbu and several other oil reprocessing centers had taken about 4 million barrels a day, at least temporarily offline. And yet the price of oil went down, which by any other normal time, that would have caused a spike because that means more oil is not going to get out. Whether there's the Bab el-Mandab is open or closed, if you can't refine it, you can't get anything out. What do you make of those two opposite indicators?
Well, we also saw another exercise in shorting oil. So friends of Trump, they're on Wall Street, and many of these people are part of the larger Zionist billionaire club, have all made lots of money as a result of his ability to manipulate the market. I think we're reaching an end of that. It's going to end very abruptly and badly. But right now, they're willing to play along on the assumption that somehow or another we're going to win, that we will walk away victorious. Because if you go to Wall Street, you talk to the people that work there, they say, oh, well, you know, taking care of the Strait of Hormuz, that's a job for the Navy and the Marines. That's a non-issue. That's all going to work out. Well, there's no evidence for that, but that's what they believe. That's what they believe because that's what Washington is telling them. And these are traders. These are people who are trading in commodities, making lots of money. These are not people that wore hard hats on a drilling rig. These are not people that have ever seen the oil fields up close and personally in the Persian Gulf or anywhere else. This is a common problem in New York City. People sit behind a desk. They're in Wall Street. They're looking at data and statistics. Those things are easily manipulated. But it's not going to last much longer. And I think that's the real message. You know, nothing is leaving the Gulf that Iran doesn't want to get out. And when you look at the oil that's leaving, it's Iranian and it's headed largely to China.
That's exactly right. And just to put a finer point on that, this is even lower than I thought. This is the current live price here, $78.60, down another 395 or 4.7%. And you can see that, I mean, this is after the Saudi Arabia announced today that they had all those millions of barrels offline while they're going to try and repair that stuff. And it just should never happen here. And that just seems to imply that somebody is definitely pulling some financial strings here, because otherwise that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, there are two other myths that we need to explode. One is that that's the real price. The price of oil coming off the ship that docks with a full load is $140 a barrel, right? That's the paper price. That's Wall Street's perception. So that's number one. Number two, there are no new oil pipelines being installed. No new oil infrastructure. I hear people saying, oh, we're already building ways to get around all this and new pipelines are popping up. No, they're not. No one is investing in the region. No one will put a dime into the region until the war stops. Come on, wake up, smell the coffee. What's the point of trying to put a parallel oil line in anywhere when you know the Iranians will discover it and they can destroy it in a few seconds? What's the point? So there's nothing good happening at all. So when the truth really strikes home, and it's going to in the near future, imagine the shock when you're looking at $150 a barrel or higher. Because if you listen to Jeff Curry and other people who are familiar, Pilkington's another one, these people have been in the oil business, trading business forever. They know what's happening. They know where we're headed. It's not where we're looking at that chart right now.
Yeah, and I wonder if you could, I want to go down that path that you just mentioned here, because last week we showed on one of our programs that Jesse Waters was bragging about how President Trump had gotten the prime minister of Iraq to have all this oil infrastructure and investment by the United States into Iraq. They were going to build this pipeline that was going to bypass the Strait of Hormuz. There's some other pipelines. And so we're going to take all the leverage away from Iran. But I wonder if you could just talk militarily, given the capabilities that we know Iran has with all these short, medium, and long-range missiles scattered throughout their country. Even if you make pipelines, unless they're all totally underground and there's nothing above ground, it seems to me that the refineries aren't going anywhere. And whether there's a pipeline or a ship, you can still take that stuff out with the same ease. Is that not correct?
Oh, no, that's true. But let's stop and ponder that statement for a second. This is Iraq. Iraq is Iran's ally. Wake up. The Iraqi government, how many times has the parliament in Iraq voted us out of Iraq? How many times have we been directed to leave the place and take our forces with them? You know, the Iraqi militias that we talk about all the time that have attacked us and others on several occasions, they're all poised to march in and seize control of Kuwait. I mean, what does he think he's talking to? I mean, this is just complete and utter nonsense. The Iraqis are not going to do anything in any way, shape, or form that could hurt Iran. Iran is their eternal ally at this point. So I don't know what he's talking about. Everybody in D.C. is inside a bubble, and I think everybody's smoking crack cocaine. Doesn't make any sense.
Well, I guess it makes sense in terms of finances, because you can make a deal all day long if you want to, and if it benefits Iran, Iraq, that's fine. But that's not going to change the internal dynamics that you talked about that we ushered in with the removal of Saddam Hussein all those years ago with the 2003 war. But I digress. Let's stick with the one we got here, though, because we have those issues at play right now. The Strait of Hormuz is in control of the Iranian side, and there's nothing we have been able to do to stop it. Not the 40 days, not the blockade, not the MOU, and then not this 13-day, attempt of mini offensive that we tried. That didn't make any change either. Now that there's been, three or four days now, we haven't struck, and I think we're trying to figure out what to do. Well, one thing that a lot of people want to do is that let's go back and finish the job. So all kinds of people have been saying that and begging Trump. I showed one over the weekend, Sid Rosenberg on Fox News, literally begging Trump to go in all out to include a ground formation, invade the country. It's shocking me to do that. Well, President Trump this morning addressed that possibility.
I could knock out the power plants. Within one day, all of their power plants would be gone. And I let them know that, with negotiations. They said, look, people want me to do that. I think I get almost the same thing out of it as doing it. But the problem is they'll never be able to, I think about 91 million people without power, without bridges, would have to live. And it's a very, very delicate balance. Yeah. So I think we have a very strong position right now. They know I'm going to do that if they don't make a deal. The bridges are going to be gone. I would say in 2 hours, most of the bridges, the major bridges, will all be gone. And the power plants in one day. If I can avoid doing that, I'd like to do that.
Yeah, he could. I mean, we have the wherewithal. We have the missiles and everything else that can do that. But the Iranian side has already said it's an eye for an eye. If you do that, we're going to hit all the infrastructure there, too. Do you think President Trump is not aware of that he doesn't believe it? Or is all of this just posturing and he's not going to do it?
This is the man who said, war may be over in 3 or 4 days. The Iranian regime, may just implode quickly. If it doesn't, what are we talking about? 2 weeks, 3 weeks? They can't stand up to us. I'm going to make a civilization disappear overnight. I mean, come on. Why listen to anything the man says? Right? The man is going to do what Netanyahu wants him to do. Let's be frank. That's where we're headed. What does Netanyahu want? He wants the war to continue. Zelensky is joined at the hip with Netanyahu. They are part of the same cabal. What does Zelensky want? He wants the war to continue. For it to continue, he needs more missiles, more drones that he can hurl at the Russians. Now, let's get real and look at what is and is not possible. Iran's goal in the war, number one, was to survive. They're not deluded. They never harbored any illusions about their real power and influence. They understood that the best they could do was to defend themselves. Dan, they've done that. They've proven that they have survived. They realize that they've won. That was the point of the MOU that Trump signed and then walked away from, unsurprisingly. Because it effectively said, okay, you get what you want, you won, we'll go along with it, we'll tolerate it because it's in the interest of the global economy. Well, that went away. He can't tolerate that. Now, what's goal number two for the Iranians? They need to finish the job. And what does that mean to them? That means that you've got to remove the United States from the region. How do you do that? You smash all the bases beyond repair. You make it patently obvious that any attempt to come back into that region and reestablish yourself on the ground is an impossibility. We are not fighting the war we were fighting just a few weeks ago. Donald Trump is fighting a rear guard action to try and preserve what little is left of our military, political, and economic power and dominance. And there's not that much left anymore. His attack on Iran was an acid test for our military power, our strength. We could have avoided it. We didn't need to do it. It was not required. But Netanyahu and his agents in the United States insisted upon it. Trump owes them whatever, and so he's done it. They're back, and they're going to tell him the only way this war ends is with the complete and utter destruction of Iran. I would turn that around and warn everyone that if he indeed does proceed, it's not the end of Iran. It'll finish us in the Gulf. That's absolutely certain, but it will be the end of Israel. And I think that privately, Netanyahu is worried about that, but he doesn't know what else to do. And the simple truth is the same for Ukraine. Either we give them more to sustain them for another month or two, or they too will go out of existence. And if we give them something to sustain them for another month or two, half of which will be stolen and end up in private bank accounts, they too will be destroyed. The handwriting, as we say, is on the wall. Ukraine is destroyed. That nation is finished. And oh, by the way, Iran is victorious, and a new order is going to emerge in the Middle East. And I would tell you that over the next few months, it will be obvious that that new order consists of four powerful states: Russia, China, Iran, and Turkey. I predict that Turkey will finally get off the bench and demonstrate that it is part of that axis. And that is the end of us and the finish of Israel in the region.
Well, that certainly may well be the case, and we'll see how things play out. What seems to propel that forward is if we make some foolish decisions here coming up. I want to point out, Gary was showing you those images from just a few minutes ago, I think, in the White House, where they're meeting between the two delegations is going on. I want to remind everybody that prior to the start of this war, Benjamin Netanyahu came to Washington, and he had some intelligence that said he found out that the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, was going to be in a certain location on a certain day, and that President Trump had to act then. That's when he had to strike. Now then, we have, prior to Benjamin Netanyahu getting here, another piece of secret intelligence that Iran is about ready to start a new nuclear weapons program at Pickaxe Mountain, and he's basically going to suggest President Trump strike that. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that makes perfect sense. That is totally in line with everything that we've been discussing. This is the last desperate attempt to keep the war going. Now, I don't know what is inside or under Pickaxe Mountain. I don't know what the intelligence services say. I don't think it matters. I mean, our intelligence services have reported pretty consistently over the last several years. There was no evidence for a nuclear bomb being developed by Iran for use against anybody. Well, they can say anything they want, and that's what's going to happen. Again, the point is, this is it. Trump has got a real problem because we are not simply low in missiles and precision-guided munitions and so forth, whether it's Tomahawks or JASMs or any number of these exotic weapons. We are. We're going to scrape the bottom of the barrel. And by the way, the oil situation is not good. What Wall Street believes and what is real are completely distinct from each other. The real world is going to come down on us very hard in the very near future. And that's going to have an impact on the bond market that we've discussed in the past, which Guntlach and Grohman and a host of other people, Ray Dalio, have all pointed to and said, you know, Armageddon is on the way. Nassim Taleb has said it before anybody. It's coming. It's inevitable now because Trump is running what's left of us in the ground. He's doing it because he understands he's fighting a rear guard action. We have lost in Iran. We have lost in Ukraine. When I say we, I'm talking about the United States, because we put the full faith and credit and power of the United States behind these very stupid, unnecessary wars. All of our allies are on the skids. Everybody's going broke. Nobody has any money. There will be no great mobilization of Europe against Russia. But what's happened in the meantime? China, which has profited enormously from our stupidity, is the rising power in the world. It is de facto the greatest economy in the world today. In terms of purchasing parity, absolutely, without question. So then we turn away from China, we look at Russia. Russia is in superb condition because the Russians have husbanded their resources. They have moved cautiously and deliberately, although I think that's about to change. And I guess we'll talk about that in a minute. But then you also have to look at Iran. Iran was supposed to have gone under several times. Its population was supposed to have starved and died and begged for mercy several times. The Iranians are not interested in talking to us anymore. No one is calling Trump and asking for talks. He's desperate for them. They're not going to happen. There is only one way out for Donald Trump and Iran, and that is for us to pack up our things and steal away into the night to disappear quietly. If we don't do that, it will get worse for us. The rest of the global energy structure will be at high risk, much of it in the Gulf region destroyed, not just for a year or two, not for 3 or 4 years, for a decade or more. And when we leave, it's very obvious what happens. The only power in the world with the wealth, the expertise, and the power to come in there and change anything, make anything right, rebuild anything, is China. And the Turks are watching it. They're seeing who is winning and who is losing. It's only a matter of time. They want to be on the winning team, and they will join. And that'll be the end of it. And this thing we call Israel, which is a product of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, will be on the skids. They'll have a choice put to them. Either you live within the broader regional framework that we define on our terms, or you go away.
Yeah, and of course, with their 200 nuclear weapons, I think that they can either just burn the whole thing down or they'll fall into line there. But that's going to be an ugly situation, which I think we're headed toward. I don't disagree with your assessments there.
Large numbers of Israelis are buying up as much of Cyprus as they can. They're moving to Greece. They're moving into Serbia. They're moving into a number of different places, Argentina, obviously. So that tells you something about the faith of the Israelis in their own future.
Yeah, and one wonders if that's ever going to get through to Netanyahu in time. Before we skip moving on that topic, because I do want to go to the Russia-Ukraine portion of that, because they are directly linked. We showed you the meeting there with Netanyahu that was happening. One of the other things that I'd like your view on here, however that comes out, and I think we have a pretty good idea how it's going to come out, that meeting, probably going to be something bad for us. But what really irks me, just as an American, is this statement here by Smotrich, Bezalel Smotrich. This was in actually the military.com this morning. Israeli minister says U.S.-Iran war is best for us without Israeli involvement. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said that plainly what other Israeli leaders have communicated more cautiously, the current U.S. war benefits Israel most when American forces do the fighting and Israel remains outside the direct exchange. This just drives me crazy, Doug, because we just talked about how Israel prompted President Trump to forget about America first and go Israel only and start this war. And then he allowed Israel to stay out of it and let our people pay the price in blood, let our population pay the physical cost from this with our tax money and or borrowing and everything else. How can President Trump let this continue on to let them stay on the sidelines and only allow our people to pay the price for a war we don't need?
Well, you will remember when we were in Saudi Arabia in 1990 and 1991 that the Saudi government, its spokespersons, its ruling elites, openly referred to the United States Army on the ground in Saudi Arabia as their white slave army that had been purchased and equipped to defend Arabia. And that's why they were there. And that when they'd done their job, they would leave because, of course, Arabia is wholly Islamic territory. Now you're hearing effectively the same thing from the Israelis. And I think he's telling you the truth. You know, there's been an effort to create the illusion that what we do and what the Israelis do militarily in the region are disconnected, that one is disengaged from the other. Well, if that were true, there would be no reason for the meeting in Washington right now involving Mr. Netanyahu with President Trump. People aren't stupid. People in the region know that. And it's interesting that the arrogance has reached the level that it has. I think this is a level of Israeli Zionist arrogance that perhaps we've only seldom seen, certainly not since 45 on this scale. And he's telling you the truth. And he expects this to happen. And President Trump is obedient. And given the fact that he is evidently under duress, he will comply.
Oh, that's... I want to argue with you, but I can't. I mean, when we see that in the midst of all this, we are at least in the seal in the process. The House already voted on this, you know, tying the U.S. military together. Apparently, the Senate is soon to vote on the NDAA. It's going to tie the intelligence to it as well. It just doesn't make any national sense at all. And yet it just continues on, even with all this information out there.
If in 1939, the United States Congress had voted on similar legislation that linked us to Great Britain, there would have been open rebellion in the United States. Americans would have been in the streets. Americans were violently opposed to the Second World War. Too many of them had been involved in the First World War, which in retrospect, they decided was a complete waste of time. Should never have happened. We fought the wrong people in the wrong place for the wrong reason. We helped the two great imperial powers to survive. We helped to establish communism in Russia. People said, forget it. We want nothing to do with this. Imagine today what would happen if people were Americans again. And I asked myself this, where are the Americans? The Americans need to stand up and say, what? Our intelligence, our technical development, our technology, all of these things are now to be shared unquestioningly and routinely with this little state of Israel, which is just a beachhead for international Zionist finance and power. Who did this? In 1939, people that advocated that sort of thing would have been called traitors and risked being hanged. Today, what do we say? Everyone's asleep. I hear nothing. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. Well, things are about to matter, just as the price of oil matters.
Yep, there's no doubt about that. And I wish that were the only issue that of similar category, but there is this other one, and that is with the fact that Zelensky is also meeting with President Trump today, and he's also going to be asking for yet more support from President Trump. And remember, just last month, we had Secretary of State Marco Rubio say, we picked a side. We're no longer trying to be even pretending to be a mediator. We picked a side, and it's Ukraine. I don't know why you would want to pick a side this late in the process when it's very clear that the Ukraine side has already lost, and it's just a matter of how big that loss is going to be. But I don't know. We'll see what's going to happen. But let me show you what Zelensky is doing, because more than just asking for President Trump for help, he's also trying to expand the war.
If Iran, from the first year of the war, gave new page, new technology to Russia. It was Shahid drones. They gave thousands of these drones first year of the war. Then they gave licenses. What did they do? Did they attack us? I think yes. So they already did it. But we have to be honest. Iranians and North Koreans already attacked us.
And of course, the Ukrainians just attacked an Iranian ship. The Iranian foreign minister said that that will not go without warning. So it seems like he's trying to physically expand the scope of the war to, again, tie the United States in together with the Israeli war and also this war here. How do you see this? What do you see as an intent here?
Well, let's look at it from the standpoint of Netanyahu and Zelensky. This makes perfect sense. Netanyahu and Zelensky are both two peas in a pod. There's not very much difference between the two. And Zelensky is effectively saying something that my friend Marty Seif likes to remind people. You know, Raymond Aron, he's a famous French political scientist, used to say, large states do what they want, small states do what they must. Well, sometimes small states make large states do what they want. And right now, Israel has us under control and is committing us, our resources, our interests, our armed forces, everything against Iran. Now, Zelensky has stepped up and says, I too want to commit all the resources of the United States, its armed forces, and the interests of the American people to my war against Russia, which is effectively tied to my friend and comrade Netanyahu's war against Iran. So absolutely, he wants to expand the war. It's his last best chance in his overwrought mind, because Russia is crushing what is left of the Ukrainians on the battlefield. It's getting ready to crush what is left of the Ukrainian state on the west side of the Dnieper. We've already seen that in Odessa. Odessa is effectively shut down. And the foreign forces and officers that have been caught in this have been killed, even though nobody at NATO will admit it. It's a tragic situation. So the triumvirate right now, Zelensky, Netanyahu, Trump, is meeting with the goal of trying to figure out how they can rescue strategic defeat and turn it into a victory. And the only way they can possibly do that is for us to join them. The problem is that President Trump knows he doesn't have the means or the resources to do it. We've already exhausted ourselves. Our problems at home are far more serious, and our position financially and economically is not strong. All this nonsense about our fundamentals are great, we're productive, we're doing better than ever, we're better than ever, all of that is just bluster and nonsense. And he's going to keep it up until he can't. The question is, can he stand up to these two and say, no, I say he can't. He won't, because he's under duress, because the same cabal of billionaires, the same people backing the war against Iran, are backing the war with Russia. The hatred for Russia in the cabal against Iran is almost as bad as the hatred for Iran that Netanyahu has. It's almost as bad. We have no interest in any of this, Dan. We don't hate any of these people. There's no reason for us to. But this is where our government is. And it's very important for what you, for you to mention what you did about the Congress. Who has stood up and registered any opposition to this insanity? What, Massey, Ro Khanna, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's now out, Massey, who soon will be? What does it tell you about Washington, D.C.?
Yep.
It is a planet unto itself. You know, the rest of the planet is orbiting Washington and being told what to do by Washington without regard to the interests of the people that live on the damn planet, us.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that, obviously, as I pointed out a second ago, that's just what irks me a lot, and in this situation as well, because there are consequences to action. It's one thing if it just makes us mad, and why are you prioritizing the interests of another country? But there's a message being sent to Moscow and to also. And by the way, I don't know if any of our audience has heard, they have a few nuclear weapons, the biggest stockpile on the planet, and we seem to be ignoring that. But President Putin is not ignoring what we're saying, and he made this comment here. There's been a couple of statements he's made here in the last couple of days that I think have gotten too little knowledge anywhere in the West, certainly not on mainstream media, but I wanted to get your view on a couple of things. First of all, we're going to look at what he says about the future of Ukraine based on all of these things, because according to him, it's not going to end up the way it is right now.
Among other things, there is the western part of Ukraine, a gift from Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin to Ukraine after the war. Stalin gave these lands to Ukraine, but he gave them as part of a single state. Apparently, it never occurred to him that a situation like today's could arise. By the way, I am sure that sooner or later Ukraine will lose these western lands. And what belonged to Poland, Hungary, and Romania sooner or later. Not tomorrow, perhaps not the day after, a year, 2, 10, or 15. But historically, everything will fall into place. There was only one guarantor of Ukraine's territorial integrity, and that was Russia. But they deemed it necessary, possible, and good for themselves to declare Russia their enemy. And to declare Russians in Ukraine a non-titular nation, which is complete nonsense and absolute rubbish.
I mean, that's kind of literally what you just said there about that we are making Russia an enemy that we don't need to make an enemy. But I want to circle back to the first of that, because two of the things she said there, I think, to Western ears are just like, well, that's obviously crazy. That's never going to happen, because he said that the lands in the Polish, which is in the yellow on the far left here, and Romania and Hungary, which is in the brown area there to the far left, the Romanian part, those two blue areas are things that are historically Romanian, have a lot of ethnic Romanians in there. He's saying that eventually those, not just that the red area on the right, which is where ethnic Russians are going to, that's basically Novorossiya, are going to end up in Russian control. But he says those other ones may end up in Polish, Hungarian, and Romanian control. Is he just being crazy, or is there something to that? I can't hear you, Doug. Here we go. Got you now.
Yeah, okay. No, there's nothing crazy about it. He's invoking something that we in the United States categorically reject out of hand, historical truth. And if you go back to not just to the Second World War, but over the last 500 years, he's describing a reality. All of those borders have shifted back and forth and changed from time to time, leaving various groups of people on one side or another of the border. And what he's suggesting is that at the end of the Second World War, Stalin set up Europe for future wars. He took all of these lands away from the Germans, gave them to the Poles, and a little bit of it called East Prussia to Russia. And then the other areas that he pointed out there ended up inside this new construct called Ukraine. Now, that doesn't mean there were never any Ukrainians. There was always a region known as Ukraina, the Ukraine. They've always been a little different in terms of their language. And the further west you go, the more different they become genetically. But the point is, everything he said is accurate. And the only way to really settle this war in any way that makes sense is to bring in the countries that border Ukraine and Russia. In other words, you come to the table and you have the Russians at the table. And we could host this if we were even remotely objective, but we're not. But the Germans could probably do it if they got rid of Merz and put in a real German government. And then you have Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, especially Lithuania that borders Ukraine, White Russia, Belarusia, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania. All of those states should sign up for whatever solution we create. And what he's suggesting is that these are historical areas that the people who live there would like to have back. You know, these areas were Hungarian for centuries. The other areas were part of Poland for centuries, a place called Galicia. And the people that lived on the edge of that were called Ruthenians. These are the Western Ukrainians. And then, of course, you have the Romanians. But the point is, he's right. Unfortunately, he's speaking to the wrong audience. The West, the people in France, people in Paris, London, Berlin, less so in Berlin, but certainly in Paris and London and Washington, they don't know anything about this. They didn't know anything about it at Versailles in 1919, which is one of the reasons that Versailles created these bastardized solutions, a crazy solution such as Czechoslovakia, two groups of people that hate each other and never wanted to live in the same country. But we made it happen. You know, we did that to Yugoslavia, forcing groups of people into one country and one state that never wanted to be there. These things were always going to break apart. They were going to fall apart when the external forces that created them were no longer present. We're finished in Iran. We should finish up and get out of Europe. These matters do not concern us. They are meaningless to us. And this little minority right now that is controlling American defense and foreign policy, as well as, I would argue, the financial future of our country, as well as the media and many other aspects of our society, including what our children study in school. All of these things need to end. We need to go back to being Americans. It's not just a question of America first. It is a question of our priorities. And our priorities are here at home. They always have been. And Americans, if you go back over the polling data for many, many years, have never wanted war with anybody. And that was true before World War I. It was true before World War II. It was true before and during the Korean War. And it was certainly true after Vietnam. And we have not learned the lesson. Instead, we found workarounds. We abandoned the gold standard so that we could print as much money as we'd like. And we could pay for whatever we wanted to do in a way that we thought could be concealed from the American people because there were no war taxes. In other words, there was no consequences, you point out, for our actions. And we also did it so that we could field what they call a volunteer force. And if you listen to what Smotrich said, and then you listen to what some of the political figures inside the United States routinely say about the Americans in uniform, is, oh, well, they volunteered. It's their problem. You know, sorry, you volunteered. That's the way it is. In other words, whose skin is in the game? That's what Nassim Taleb always likes to ask. Whose skin is in the game? Your skin, my skin, but not their skin. And who is their skin? The people that are driving these wars in both Ukraine and Iran. These are the people controlling Donald Trump and our Congress.
Yeah, that was. I actually did a show on Sunday with Sid Rosenberg, conservative radio talk show host, was featured on Fox News on set. And he made that very argument. He said, yeah, I think President Trump needs to go in on the ground in Iran with boots on the ground. That's why these guys signed up. We don't have a draft. They signed up for this, et cetera. Just drove me crazy. Sorry, that's kind of an aside.
Well, we need to ask the question, who is Sid Rosenberg? Why does Sid Rosenberg take these positions? To whom is he connected? Sid Rosenberg is part of the larger cabal. You know, think of the cabal as an octopus with tentacles reaching out to many different people in all walks of American life, whether it's finance or Hollywood, media, any of these other things. And they're reporting back and responding to the same stimuli that Donald Trump is and Congress is. I don't know Sid Rosenberg. I wouldn't know him if I fell over the man. I'm sure he's a nice guy. But the question that has to be asked is, how did you arrive at this conclusion that the wealth and power and influence of the United States should be put at risk in a war with Iran and the Iranian nation? Who made that decision? How did we get here? Why are you supporting it? I think it could be ugly, because I don't think the American people, if they were asked to vote on any of this, would support any of it.
I'm very confident of that. And unfortunately, this same power base that you're talking about here seems intent to try to draw us into a war with Russia, no matter what, whether we want to or not. And Russia can only be pushed so far. And I think that we're eventually going to get what we're looking for. In a speech this weekend, or maybe it was even, yeah, I think it was this weekend, yesterday, President Putin went on there. He actually addressed something you and I've talked about many times over the last year or so about why Russia hasn't gone farther and why they hadn't taken more risk militarily to bring this war to a conclusion. And he actually answered that question for the first time I've ever seen in some detail, where he said, I have prioritized the stability of our country. We've withstood all these sanctions. We've withstood everything that all the NATO countries have done. And we have risen to the number four globally and the number one in Europe purchasing power, PPP, et cetera. And he said, we're the top around that there. However, he said, it may be time to do something different, and it may be time to take some risk, as he said here.
I will reveal a secret. My colleague will not be offended that during the award ceremony, one of the recipients whispered to me, we will win. We need to be bolder. I really want that. But a question arises, even bolder. And here, just as in the economy, there are risks. The press is losses on the battlefield on our side. Therefore, we will also act carefully here, but persistently and consistently achieving the goals set for the country, and we will achieve them.
Now, I think that he's coming to the conclusion, Doug, and I like your assessment of this, that there are also risks to not doing these things, to not being more bold, which is what apparently many of the military folks, even higher ups in the Kremlin, have been asking for. And then here we see this just the news a couple of days ago that there, and this is not just from the Ukraine side, this is Kiev Post that Zelensky was talking about, but this is coming from the Russian media as well. And Putin was implying that they may be going to mobilize 500,000 additional as recently or as soon as September. So it seems that Russia may seriously be thinking about finally doing some of the things on the battlefield that you've been talking about. How do you see that?
President Putin understands something with great clarity that I don't think President Trump or any of his predecessors, probably in the last 30 years, have thoroughly grasped. His job is threefold. One, he's got to protect the United States. Number two, he's got to shelter the population. In other words, provide the kind of roofs over our heads that we deserve and need as people. And three, it's got to feed us. You know, you could broaden that to talk about ensure our prosperity, our standard of living. So shelter, protect, feed. That's what President Putin was talking about. And people have questioned repeatedly, why has he not moved more decisively? Well, when he started, I don't think he fully grasped the threat that was presented to him. I think he knew the West was going to press NATO, and he was trying to prepare for that. But I don't think he appreciated the true mendacity and hatred that people that were leading the West felt for Russia. And I'm not saying that that's the views of all Europeans, but I'm saying the people in charge, the globalists, you can call them whatever you want, their various names. And he had to take stock of what he thought. About 2 months, 3 months in, he said, you know, I was wrong. I went in very light. I thought that we could minimize fighting. I didn't want to kill very many Ukrainians if I could avoid it. I regard them as Slavic Orthodox brothers. And I made a mistake. And finally, he sat with his leading general officers and they told him the truth. This won't work. You're going to have to back up, re-examine everything. We need a new plan to go forward. That new plan then becomes a strategic defense. We've talked about this before. The withdrawal over the Dnieper River from Kherson and the establishment of the strategic defense with a defense in depth and a line that then creates this ISR strike complex that becomes the meat grinder that ultimately kills a million plus Ukrainians. Now, he did that. And he built up the force. And he also looked at the manufacturing base and he recognized that much of it had to be put back into action to build the material strength for the Russian armed forces. He did that. In other words, he reallocated resources, but he did it in a way that was designed to preserve the standard of living in Russia, to ensure that the Russian people were fed. In other words, that they retained an acceptable standard of living, that the Russian people were sheltered and protected. That's very important. And he has now reached a point where he realizes he possesses the power and the strength to implement a full-scale war against Ukraine. Because up until this point, a war with Ukraine has been a special military operation. I think that's another reason that Zelensky is in the meeting with Netanyahu and Trump, because just as Iran has turned out to be far stronger and more robust to recover much more quickly than everybody thought. The same is true for Russia. Russia is now a leading power in the world, as Putin pointed out in his speech. And this leading power is going to win. And he told the Russian people, we are now going to ramp up the war. We're going to attack. We're going to win. And I think you're going to see that. It's already begun in Odessa. I think you're going to see it in Kharkov. And I think it will then advance to the river and perhaps beyond, depending upon the circumstances. So that's the Putin answer. We've already talked about the Iranian answer. No talks. We've won. We're in charge. We will not be dislodged. And we will make it impossible for you Americans to return to the region. So the question is, what do we do? Are we going to be talked into joining the war on Ukraine's side? Not just shipping them missiles and equipment. Are we going to put together some ridiculous force of the willing that was discussed several years ago that has a snowball's chance in hell of winning against the Russian force that exists today? And I think what Putin is also saying is that if you choose to do this, we will be ready. And if you challenge us, we will oblige you with the war you say you want. And God help you. So I hope that President Trump works his way through this. I hope someone tells him the truth about the real state of the war in both the Middle East as well as in Ukraine. But there's no certainty of that. And we still don't know precisely why President Trump is under duress and feels obligated to obey the dictates of these people backing not just Netanyahu, but also Zelensky.
And Doug, let's say that the trends that you identified in both of these two wars carries through, that Netanyahu talks Trump into doing, whether it's Pickaxe Island or any other target, or just going back into trying the impossible again. And that, I mean, even if we don't join on the ground with Ukraine, but we continue supporting such that eventually Russia moves forward, what is that going to do to the United States if we don't recognize these things now by choice, but that we get sucked into to both these wars in a deeper place? Is it possible that we could be physically defeated, not just an embarrassment like in Afghanistan or Vietnam, but like actually lose a conflict somewhere?
Well, keep in mind that both the Biden and Trump administrations have been fighting the same conflicts. These conflicts are as follows: to back Israel and its supporters in a ruthless war of extermination against Israel's enemies in the Middle East. That's not just Iran. It's everyone and anyone that borders Israel or is close to Israel that threatens Israel. Then there's the war to exhaust Russian military and economic power in Ukraine. And finally, there is the unspoken but real war to curb the dramatic growth of China's strategic, economic, and international influence. But he's in a new position now. These are no longer wars that he exerts much control over. Trump's wars in Ukraine and the Middle East are now rear guard actions designed to preserve as much of American political, financial, military authority over the world as possible. And the reason is simple. America's financial, economic, and military means are nearly spent. And that's the tragedy of all of this, is that we have squandered enormous wealth, enormous power, enormous credibility and prestige on these losing propositions. The smart thing a long time ago would have been to cut bait, reduce your investment, and get out. You would think as a businessman, he would understand this, but he doesn't. And I don't think he will. And so I think things are going to get much worse. And yes, we are going to be embarrassed. And when we finally depart, the degree to which we have been defeated will be significant, and it will not be lost on the rest of the world that understands very clearly what I just said.
Yeah, and I think it will not be lost on the American people either. And then there will be bills to pay for all of these elite who have been supporting this. We'll have to wait and see how that's going to come out. But history being a guide, it's not going to be pretty. It could have been avoided, but I think we're probably beyond that. In any case, we appreciate you coming on today and making this very clear to us. Also, a reminder to everybody, go to McGregorWarrior.substack.com. You can see all kinds of stuff like what you see on the screen right there. Why is America's army falling apart? Lots of good stuff on there. Doug McGregor's Warrior Substack. Thanks a lot for coming on, Doug. We always appreciate you.
Thank you, Dan.
And we will be back with you guys in just about 10 minutes from now, a little bit less than that, with Robert Barnes. He's going to be back on us, and he's always got some insights into what's going on inside the administration. We've heard from Doug about what's going on outside. We're about to find out what may be going on inside, and is there any inside hope that maybe some of the off-ramp that Doug was talking about could be taken? We'll find out in about 10 minutes with Robert Barnes. See you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.